Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. Joining me today is author Danielle McLaughlin. Her debut collection of short stories, Dinosaurs and Other Planets, was published in Ireland by the Stinging Fly Press in 2015, and her first novel, The Art of Falling, was shortlisted for the Dublin Literary Award in 2022. In 2023, she was the recipient of a Markievicz Award, and her latest novel, Rituals, is out now with the Stinging Fly. If you know the podcast at all, you know that I usually take people back right to the very beginning of their reading life. So just the sort of little girl you were and the sort of reader you might have been if you were a reader when you were small.
I was very bookish child, I think, maybe partly because I was a quiet child and I was an awkward child, socially awkward, introvert even back then, you know, and I was very much in my own head. A little bit in a world of my own. And maybe I was kind of a child who thought things through too much, you know, and I would come up with all kinds of catastrophic scenarios about things that might happen, you know. But yeah, books were great. And I've always been really lucky. And I think, you know, maybe I only appreciate this, you know, reaching adulthood, because as a child, I think maybe, you know, I wouldn't have appreciated it, but there were always books in our house from when I was very tiny. Like, I always had books, and I know I'm very fortunate to have had that. And my mother and father kept loads of my childhood books. So I still have those in my house here now. And with them are some books that I read as a child, but they had been my mother's books. You know, so she passed them down to me and I read them as a child, and now I have them in my house here. So I'm really lucky that way. And some of those old books, they're fascinating in so many ways, and they are so beautiful. Like, one of the things that really struck me, and like my brain has just been buzzing in recent days thinking, because I, you know, coming on this podcast has got me thinking back and looking back at some of those childhood books. And my brain is really buzzing because I was struck by how many Irish language books for children are within that set of childhood books. Really, really beautiful Irish language books that were published back in... So I was born in 69, so books that were published back in the 1960s and 70s and in Irish, and they're really, really gorgeous. And, you know, I can't speak Irish, or not well, but I love Irish. A bit like Joan in Rituals, I am currently trying to get back, because my Irish used to be better. I'm trying to get back into Irish and being able to speak it. And my daughters both love Irish, and they would be quite good at Irish. So I have been in recent times taking out some of my Irish language books from childhood and reading them again as an adult trying to learn. And that has been fabulous. But all the illustrations in those books.
Do you have one there? I know it's no good to our listeners, but I want to see one.
Well, I chose a couple because I thought I would show you, but this is my favourite, I think. It's called Kiki agus Scéalta Eile, and it's really, really large, and it's got this kind of board cover and a cloth-bound spine, mm-hmm. and it's short stories for children, and Kiki in the title story is a swan. And others, I still remember there's a story about a donkey called Railteen Bawn. And I still, you know, revisiting that illustration, I can remember how it connected with me as a child, because I loved horses and donkeys. Oh. But yeah, it's such a beautiful book.
That's gorgeous.
Fabulous. And there's a couple of Judith Kerr books in Irish. So Mog an cat dí chéile. And reading this as an adult and having a cat ourselves now, the cat psychology in this book is incredible. Like, this was written by someone who understood cats. So, yeah, and an tigre a hánaigh chun té, another do the purr one. So, yeah, really beautiful Irish language books. And in a way, I feel like it's such a shame that I can't speak Irish. And what was I doing? Because obviously I had that start. I think, you know, my parents wouldn't have spoken Irish themselves, so it wouldn't have been spoken at home. But obviously they had the interest to get the books.
And there must be something in there back from those like very, very early days. There must be something like flittering about an awakening, even linguistically, perhaps. Like you say, you're sort of awakening to the sensations you had when you saw the picture of the donkey, or when you're like, so that's all kind of, that's mad, isn't it? That's sort of rekindled or something all these years later. So maybe linguistically something will, you know, something's kind of firing and connecting too.
Yeah, I think there is something in there. And I know that my grandfather on my mother's side would have had Irish. So he was a schoolmaster and he would have had good Irish. And I think even growing up, you know, it was that Hibernian English where there's lots of Irish words kind of scattered through it. So, yeah, it's kind of an in-between space in terms of language, yeah.
Or liminal, as we writers all like to say. Yeah. The most overused word. I'm just thinking about Joan and her Irish language classes in Rituals. I mean, there's some like really, really wryly funny scenes there, you know, when she's learning and she's in the group, and the teacher, even the young teacher is a great character too, isn't she?
Oh, thank you.
So, on we go a little bit into, I know you're talking about the books, so you said you were kind of you were a quiet child, you were in your own world to a certain degree and a great reader. And so that's the picture I have of you in primary school. And then when you went on into secondary school, got a little older and into adolescence, how did you respond to books then? And what kind of things would you be reading then?
I think through, say, secondary school years, a lot of my reading would have revolved around what we were given to read in school. So it would have been the textbooks alongside whatever books we had at home. So as I got like through my older childhood, I would have read things like Anne of Green Gables and Little Women and Treasure Island and all that. And before that, all the Enid Blytons. And yeah, I loved English class at school, like that English and history, I think, because they both had the stories. So that was what I really liked, rather than the ones that had figures and numbers in them. But yeah, there's a book from my late teens that I kind of think of as a book that changed in a way my way of going through the world or the way I saw things. And I would have read it maybe when I was 18 or 19. And it was White Sargasso Sea by Jean Rhys. That book just blew me away. It kind of tilted the axis of my world a little bit, because I think I was a very naive, unquestioning child going through life, you know, in my own head and absorbing so many things through books that I was just taking in. And here with White Sargasso Sea was a book that was actually challenging another book as I saw it. And not only any book, but a really, really famous book. So White Sargasso Sea is written as a prequel to Jane Eyre. And it tells the story of Antoinette, or Mr. Rochester's wife, Bertha, who was locked up in the attic. And I thought, wow, so there's actually another story to this story. And I thought, this is incredible. So, because I think up to then I would have read a famous kind of classic book and sort of accepted it and not thought too much beyond the frame of the book and the story itself. And here was a book that was kind of almost standing right up to this other book and saying, there's another story here, and Jean Rhys saying, I'm going to tell a different story now, and just realizing, yeah, that there are so many different versions of stories. And it's kind of, I suppose, White Sargasso Sea was a book that challenged the accepted narrative of that story. And back then, I wouldn't even have had the words to put it that way. But it was just inside me, something shifted and made me realize, look behind these characters, there's another story here, and there's another version of events, and made me think of how much it matters who gets to tell the story. So that's a book I've reread over the years, and yeah, it has popped up in my own writing, so I reference it. It's a book that one of my characters reads in one of my short stories, for example. So yeah, that had a big influence, because I think it taught me to ask questions, maybe, and to think of different angles or possibilities beyond the stated ones, beyond what is being handed to me to question.
And I mean, aside from the whole mad woman in the attic and the sort of feminist kind of direction that that book probably helped not inspire, but was part of that whole movement, apart from that sort of side of things, you know, about like the lens of how you read and the kind of question mark that that brought into everything, which is really quite it is amazing when that happens, it's sort of like a veil is lifted, isn't it? And you kind of go, oh, for good and for bad, you know, it's sort of like, oh, but I kind of loved Mr. Rochester. You know, there's a bit of that too, but like, and I know I love Joan in Rituals has many, many volumes of Jane Eyre, and I loved that. But did it change? I mean, I know this is quite a facile question really, because we're talking about bigger things, but just about Jane Eyre itself, because, you know, I presume that you loved that book before you read Sargasso Sea, but did it change Jane Eyre then for you irrevocably and forevermore?
No, in that I reread Jane Eyre when I was writing Rituals, and I found, yeah, it's a really good book, and it's a really good story, and it stands the test of time, and it's so interesting to think about what it did. I suppose maybe things that we might take for granted about the form or style of the novel now, it would have been innovative back then. But no, I still enjoyed it. I think when I was younger, maybe I would have thought, oh, so Jane Eyre isn't the story anymore. Whereas now that I'm older, I can kind of, yeah, I enjoy both of them and I like both of them. I think it's, yeah, it taught me the importance of questioning and looking for different versions. But no, I still enjoyed rereading Jane Eyre.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you said that.
Didn't spoil it for me.
Glad you said that. Yeah, special place in my heart too, that book. Now, I don't know much about your biography or about your life, really, or, you know, what if you went to college or what you did after that. But, like, tell me a little bit about, so where we find you then after, well, you've had this illuminating moment, maybe around 18 or 19. Did you go on to university, or did you go into work, or what sort of things were you doing then as you kind of grew into adulthood?
So I would have done that. I would have read White Sargasso Sea first when I was a night student at UCC. So after my Leaving Cert, I did a secretarial course for a few months, and I learned touch typing on typewriters, which has stood me well down through the years. And then I got a job in the public service. So a bit like Joan and Rituals, I got a job in the public service. I didn't stay. Joan stayed a long time. I didn't, but I did stay for a number of years. And during those years, I was studying at UCC. So I read White Sargasso Sea as part of the English syllabus. I did English and I also did Irish.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'm just thinking, so you were working, this is, I suppose that this is where you gain your great insight into that world in Rituals, because there's some just beautiful details in there. I think, okay, that's golden. Did you draw on that, I suppose?
Yeah, I drew on lots of aspects of my own life and memories and workplace. Things I remembered for the book. being careful all the time that it, you know, it remained totally fictional.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, it was very useful to have those workplaces to kind of go back to in my head. And
because it's quite, it's the kind of sort of institutionalization of those things sort of stays with you forever, doesn't it? It's kind of like school, and you go into those kind of organizations, they're very sort of permeable in that, you know, what they do to you, really. Well, that's, I suppose that's my opinion of it, that they kind of like linger long. So you were at doing your night courses then at that point, and you were working at the same time. Was there any inkling in you to be writing at that stage, or was that just not part of you then?
What I wanted most at that stage was to go on and study law and become a solicitor. So that was the path I took, and I did more night studies in law, and my path went the solicitor route. So I think that would have been, that was kind of my dream, you know. So when people talk about how their dream was always to be a writer, I think from when I was 16, 17, I decided I wanted to be a lawyer, and that became my focus.
That's so interesting. What attracted you to that? What was it that made you kind of keen to be a lawyer or a solicitor?
Yeah, well, you know, good question, because it was something that hadn't featured in my thoughts at all until I was almost finished secondary school. And I didn't really know what I was going to do other than get a job. And I think things that I would have thought I would have liked, you know, at one point I wanted to join the army, but I only wanted to join the army so I could ride the horses, because I was horse mad. So that was my sole reason for wanting to join the army. So that didn't happen. And I wanted to be a vet. I wanted to be a vet for a while, just the animals thing, because I liked animals. But yeah, that went by the wayside. And I think there wasn't anything else that I kind of really wanted to do. And one day someone in class said that they were going to study law. And I thought, that's it. That is something that is interesting to me. And I think it dawned on me that I just loved words, and I loved writing, and I never minded when we got essays for homework or write a short story for homework. Like, I enjoyed doing that, and I found that part of the homework easy, and I never minded the time spent on those things. And then just all the stories about law, and I think obviously the whole, you know, the drama of the courtrooms, not that I had any experience of it back then, and I would have been just, you know, going from what I'd seen on television. But yeah, so and it turned out that yes, it was really interesting to me, because I just, the more I thought about it, the more I realized how much I loved the kind of the magic with words that lay behind law. So I found it so interesting, the idea that a way a sentence in legislation is drafted somewhere by somebody tucked away in an office can affect the lives of thousands of just ordinary people who are at that moment sitting down having their breakfast, and they've no idea of the consequences that are going to be visited on their lives by the way someone drafts this sentence in a piece of legislation. So that was really interesting to me, the way you could arrange words to,
yeah, power,
like power, yeah, power, and almost like a magic spell, that you get the words in the right order, in a particular order, and one thing happens, and you put those words in a different order and something else entirely happens,
a different order.
Yeah, so that really interested me, and I used to even enjoy reading things like those legal notices that they put in newspapers, you know, things like winding up of companies and stuff like that. And I just loved the rhythms and the formula, and thinking about it now, the rituals, I suppose, that there were particular rituals that you followed with words. And this was how the world moved on from one thing to the next to the next. This was how business was done, through these arrangements. of words.
Yeah, something sort of philosophical or religious about that sort of incantation of it. Nearly not, that's not the right word, but yeah, like the weight of the word and the, yeah, that's so interesting. And also the, I suppose the, you know, the stories behind the people who are coming to the law for whatever assistance and, you know, the small dramas, you know, they don't have to be massive, you know, big drama, but the small, sometimes those are even more interesting, the kind of minutiae of what people are trying to do or fix or fight over.
Absolutely. Like, I still remember, and sometimes I still enjoy doing it, reading law reports. So the main legal cases for every year are gathered together in bound books. You have that, and they're available online these days. But yeah, for me, they were like reading stories, because you did get what you were saying there, but like the details, the small but hugely important details of people's lives and the things that turned on what was said or not said or done. And they were, just to read the law reports was so interesting to me. And I teach creative writing from time to time, and I sometimes say to my students, you know, if you're anywhere, if you're near a law library, you need never be stuck for an idea for something to write about, because just take down those law reports and yeah, the stories in there. And what I love about the law reports is, because for reasons of evidence, they have to go into such precise detail and the specifics of the evidence and the detail, you get right into someone's life. And I, yeah, and you know, I think people will say things maybe when they're forced to, that they would never otherwise tell or discuss with another human being. You know, a lot of things that people are talking about in court, they wouldn't be saying it unless they absolutely had to. They wouldn't they be had saying to, it in yeah. any other forum.
I was just thinking about that. There could be like just even like really embarrassing financial details or you know, like a humiliating thing that you might have written or done or said, like, you, I know you have to. It's the truth, isn't it? Like the kind of the sort of, yeah, the hidden stuff. Oh, yeah. Oh, I can see why I enjoyed that. Well, what made you leave?
So I hadn't planned to leave. I became ill very suddenly, like almost overnight, really, back in 2009. I had one of those very rare reactions to prescribed medication. You know, one of these things that you get a box of medicine and you read the possible yeah. side effects and you think, well, you know, that's never going to happen. And most of the time that never happens. But I just had a very rare reaction to a prescribed medication, and I became very ill, and it took me a while. Like, I had to stop work, and it took me best part of a year to kind of come out the other side of it. And at that time, I had my own small legal practice. So I was my own boss, and I liked that. I think I've discovered over the years that I like working for myself and running my own little world. And it was a very small practice, but I liked working that way. So like I had to hand over my clients to another solicitor, and I was at home and I was in a lot of pain, and there was a point when I could move, you know, movement was difficult, and I could only move my fingers like this enough to work on a keyboard, you know. And when I was sick, I started writing, and actually I ended up never going back to legal practice since. So it was a complete sort of swerve. It was like a train going on to another track and heading off in another
yeah,
direction.
I mean, that is sort of a catastrophic but also kind of epiphany at the same time. Like, gosh, that's a lot in a year. Never mind, one of those things is monumental enough, even chronic pain for a year or the change in jobs or all of that. But that's when you started writing, then that's when it happened.
Yeah. And I started sending out little pieces of journalism, kind of memoir pieces that were mostly uh-huh. about being a mother and bringing up kids, because at that stage, my three kids were very young. And I had a couple of journalism pieces published. But then I got hooked on short stories, and I went to the Cork International Short Story Festival, and I did a workshop there, and then I did more workshops. And it was just so eye-opening, like all the different short story writers, because I would have known the ones we did at school, but I wouldn't have had a huge exposure to short story writing generally. So yeah, I met my writing group through those workshops. I started going to festivals and reading a lot more widely than I had been. And I started sending out short stories then. And you know, once I started writing the fiction, like I lost interest then in the journalism. There was something obsessive about writing fiction, and that totally took over. And yeah, that was what I wanted to do.
And around that time, like when you saw it, you'd left the practice and you were sick and you were starting to write, what were you reading? Like, what were you, you say you started when you went to the workshops and everything, you started reading more widely. Is there a book or books from like that period, you know, when you were going through that seismic change that you remember or that was important to you?
I remember Eoin Lee giving a reading at the Cork International Short Story Festival, and her collection of short stories, Gold Boy, Emerald Girl, really connected with me. I remember encountering Edna O'Brien's short stories, and you know, obviously I knew who Edna O'Brien was, and I would have read Country Girls when I was much, much, much younger, but I wasn't familiar with her short stories, and they were, yeah, really incredible. And from then on, really, it was just, yeah, I think I became aware of the wideness of the world of writers out there.
Rituals, we're coming back to rituals now in a minute. Danielle, I don't know whether we've touched on this. I know that you said that you've gone back to read Wide Sargasso Sea, and you've gone back to read Jane Eyre over the years. Is there another book that you go back to or that you reread time and again for any particular reason, or are you not generally the sort of person who rereads things?
Yeah, so I do reread occasionally. So Kevin Barry's short story collection, There Are Little Kingdoms, that book, a bit like it had the same kind of the same effect on me, but well, in a different way, but it had a very powerful effect on me when I read that book first, There Are Little Kingdoms. I think because I'd never encountered short stories written that way before, and their style and the way they dealt with language was so different to any of the short stories that I had encountered up to then. And also because people seemed so real. And also I thought, I know these people. These are the people who were all around me in this kind of small rural parish where I live. I know these people, like they're the real thing. They're my community. So, yeah. So I would go back to that now and again. And when I first discovered it, I used to think of it as my palate cleansing book, so that whenever I read a book that disappointed me, like, and I think I was so enthused by all this new reading and writing back then that I would take a disappointment in a book quite to heart. But I would read something from There Are Little Kingdoms, and I would be, yes, you know, this is back to writing as it speaks to me again.
Yeah, give you the fire in the belly again. And he does dialogue so well. I was actually just reading this morning about something he said about the short story. It was something along the lines of, it's like a shadow falling over you when you get the kind of, you know, the goo for like to write a short story. It's like a shadow falls over you. I just love that. Like, it's just that kind of, I don't need to say it in any other way. He said it. Okay. Now, this is a tricky question. And this is about your own work, Danielle. And it doesn't have to be published. But it's about something you would save from this hypothetical burning house, of your own writing, published, not published, doesn't matter, but one of your books or works in progress or whatever it is that you would save above the rest of them, if you can answer that.
Okay, so yeah, that's really interesting question. I think in terms of what I would save, it would be a work in progress, because I find once a book gets to a point where it's gone out into the world, I think, yeah, okay, it's out there now. If every copy that I have is, you know, gone, if I never read it again, it's out there. And there's the opportunity for someone else to read it some other time, you know. So I think it would be work in progress that I would take, because that always feels kind of precious or sort of desperate to me when it hasn't fully cohered into its end thing yet. So at the moment, so there's another novel that I've written that I'm hoping will be, you know, published someday. It's called Ambush as a working title, and it's part historic. It's set in two time periods, the set in 1921 and then in 2020, so best part of 100 years apart, and it's drawing on an element of family and local history. And because I write longhand, and because I had to do a lot of research for this one, I would take all my notebooks and I would take all the bits of research and printouts and scribblings and, you know, copies of newspaper bits from 100 years ago that I found online, all those things, I would take those out. Now, I do have, like, it's at the point where I'm sharing work from it with my writing group. So I do have versions of it on computer at this point. So it's not that it would be totally gone if I didn't find the handwritten versions. But I think until a thing is out there and published in the world, I'm still very attached to my handwritten notes, the notebooks, all the little bits of paper that have accumulated around it over a couple of years.
We're definitely saving that. I'm still astonished, actually, that you write longhand. I am gasping, like the whole thing, like the first draft. I mean, notes and everything, but yes. What is your handwriting like?
My handwriting is fairly messy, but I just love notebooks. And I have discovered something lately. It was actually a student of mine in the workshop who told me about it, called Remarkable. And I have started using that, and that is so fantastic because, well, for anyone listening who doesn't know about it, it's very small and slim. It's as light, if not lighter, than a notebook, and you write on it with an electronic pen, so you're just handwriting, and there, it feels like there's that direct connection between brain and page. But then you can click a button, and it will convert into typed text, and you can email it yourself. So I am loving using that these days. Like, I think there's still going to be times when I think at the very early stages of a project, I will still go back to the paper notebook, because I just love scribbling around and at that stage. And I do love the actual paper. But I'm really enjoying working with the Remarkable tablet. And it is saving me time because, like, even not just in writing my own work longhand, but when I'm working on maybe a student story, I will like to get my thoughts down longhand as well in the first instance. And yeah, it's wonderful because it's saving me time on retyping things.
As you are the second person to have been evangelical about Remarkable, so I'm going to look into it. Actually, it does sound fantastic. And yeah, no, I understand the sort of very early stages when you're doing all the sort of, like, you know, squiggles and diagrams and arrows and ideas and all the rest of it. I was just wondering whether you were kind of long forming writing the chapters, but I get what you're saying now. It's that sort of composty stage. Now, Are you going to answer this question or are you not going to answer this question, Danielle? This is about leaving a book to burn in the house. And again, for anyone who's never listened to the podcast, we're not advocating burning books in any way. It's a hypothetical question and we wouldn't actually really do this. But if there were a book for any reason that you would happily leave in the house to burn, you wouldn't care about it burning, what would it be?
You know, any of those books have already been got out of the house, because I find if a book really upsets me, if it's very ugly in some way, I find I don't want it in the house anyway. And sometimes I will decide that it only upset me, but that other people might get something out of it. So those will go to a charity shop. Once or twice, I've actually put a book in the bin because I thought, this is so ugly. I do not want to be responsible for any other human being reading it. So I don't have any of those, like the books that remain on my shelves. I think because I have to make space every so often because there's only so much room. So every so often I will think, well, what am I probably never going to take down and reread? Or what doesn't have any personal associations? And by that, I mean, you know, if it's a book I got at a festival and I met the writer, or if it's a book that I got at a festival I went to with a friend and we were chatting about it together, I think, oh, yeah, I have happy associations with that book and I want to keep it. No, like there's one book I have, and it's actually a book going back to childhood. It's a book aimed at very young children. And in a way, like you could say it's a book that perhaps should be left to burn, because it shocked me actually when I looked at this book. It's a book for teaching very small kids, like counting numbers 1 to 10, that sort of thing. It was published by a UK publisher back in the 1960s, I think. But it is so horribly racist that I can't even go into telling you what is in that book. And racist in its language, racist in the illustrations. And when you think this is a book aimed at maybe 4 or 5 year old kids, that is so shocking. And I've actually tried to write about that book, but I can't get any way close to finding a way of writing about it that isn't repeating the ugliness. And yes, I have tried, because part of me thinks, well, you know, that's something that kind of needs to be acknowledged, that back then, a publisher thought that there was nothing wrong with putting this book out there, designed for small children. Yeah, but in a way, burning it would be like getting rid of the evidence. You know?
The evidence.
So I've kept that book. I don't know where it is. Actually, I have a feeling I put it away somewhere. So it's probably out of sight somewhere, but I wouldn't throw it out either, because, it says something. And I think it reminded me maybe of how ingrained some of that ugliness and hatred that we kind of absorb almost unwittingly, how deeply it's in society.
That is shocking. Yeah. And the fact that it was for teaching, like, you know, numbers or maths, like, as well, it's like, that's insane.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right, probably endemic and not unusual. Well, maybe you will write a response to that at some point.
Yeah, I have tried, but I haven't found, the right way because of the sheer ugliness of the language.
Well, if I were going to just allow a book to burn, I would allow it to burn, and maybe you could find another copy to respond to. So we'll leave it at that. We'll leave it at that. Okay, now a book, not a book actually, from your house, something from your house that is not a beloved animal, not a beloved person, but it's not a book. So if there is something else, I mean, I know people say they're laptops and everything. I feel like I should exclude laptops and things like that from this question. But if there's something else that you would go in and save from your burning house, if anything, what would it be?
Oh, yeah. So I have there's a few things in competition for that. So I have a plastic tub on top of my bookshelves here, and in it are ledgers, accounts ledgers that came from a business that was in my father's family, and they date back to the 1920s and 1940s. And they're household ledgers and ledgers for a small pub and grocery shop from that time. And they have pages for all the locals and all the customers and who bought precisely what on what date. And then there's little letters mixed in between the leaves, people saying they're sorry they can't pay and things are bad. And just, I think the detail that you can get, I think there's so much lodged in the details of the food people eat and the money they spend, what they spend their money on. It's, yeah, fabulous. But in a way, I'm conscious I'm kind of cheating with that one, because in their ledger books, aren't they? So they're another type of book.
I think we could still keep this. Gosh, that goes back to the sort of law records as well, but in a very different sense, in a very lively sense, isn't it? Like, you know, Mrs. Baker comes in for her whatever, yeah, and so 1 week she doesn't, exactly. Or then there's, yeah, where there's a death and someone comes in to order things, or the thing where someone misses, or then they have a slate, or they build up their debt, or they're, oh, I love that. That's very precious.
Very precious.
Okay. We're saving, I think you're allowed to save something else, and if there's something in competition, because that is sort of a book, but in betweeny. So do you have something else as well? Did you say there was something in competition?
Yeah, there's a couple of things in competition. So a friend of mine, so I had a friend who died young of cancer. So she was only maybe, she was about 30, early 30s when she died. But she had gone to Russia when she was younger, working for a while, and she brought me back a set of those Russian dolls. So I have that. And actually, I think, you know, over the years, some of the dolls went missing, which is such a pity now. But I think in the chaos of all the child rearing and, you know, the mess of those years, a couple of them fell by the wayside, but I still have some of them. So I think I would take that.
Okay. We're saving yeah, those. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Now, Danielle, we're going to move on to rituals now. But I know you're going to read for us a little bit from it shortly, but the fabulous Joan in rituals, tell the readers a little bit about her. I mean there's other people in the book too, but she's a central character. Maybe tell our listeners just a little bit about her and a little bit about the book.
Yeah, so Joan is in her mid-50s. She's a public servant. She's been in the public service for years and years, and she's living in Cork. And because of something that has happened in her life, she finds herself on a career break from the public service. And in order to bring in a little bit of money and also to have someone to discuss books with, she decides she's going to take in a lodger, and she takes in a 20-year-old English undergrad from the local university. And Joan has, I suppose, she's found a way of getting through life on a day-to-day and month-to-month and year-to-year basis by having her own set ways of doing things, of having rituals, some of which are maybe ordinary rituals and some are decidedly strange and odd rituals, but these help her get through her days. And she's used to living by herself all these years with her rituals. So it is a big shock to Joan's system when this young man comes into her space and into her life. And the book is, I suppose it's about their relationship and about how their lives collide and feed into each other, and how they help each other, I suppose. And they unsettle each other and they help each other too, I think. And they open up, they each open up, I think, another version of the world for the other.
I love, I mean, they're the book is called Rituals, and Joan has various rituals that she kind of. I'm going to read this one out to you because I just love this one so much. This is Joan here. She kept her eyes on the lodger, ready to drag him from the path of passing lorries. Joan had yet to save anybody's life, despite deciding at the age of 9 that it was a merit she needed to earn. She wanted credit in her favour for when she accidentally killed someone, which back then she believed was only a matter of time. I just love that.
That's Joan. I think that particular part is probably, yeah, me going, that's childhood me as well, I think, because I was always I used to think that, yeah, high likelihood that I was going to mess something up very badly, but at least if I had managed to save someone, you could, like, it was credit debit, you know.
Exactly. I just, that was, oh, it was so good. And then on a slightly more serious note, then there were just, there's a sort of a sense of shame to her, I think, which comes in and out and ebbs and flows in it, which is kind of, it's quite moving as well. She's quite self-aware. And I think I'm not even going to give the context, because this is later on in the book, but she says, you know, but what could she say? For all that her life felt imbued with unspecific shame, what had she actually done that was wrong? And I love that sort of non-specific shame that sort of dogs her around. But one thing I really loved as well about this book was the sort of percolation of the love and sort of worry about animals that runs through it in one form or another. A pair of great hens in this. What are their names? Joan's next door neighbour has a pair of hens.
Oh yeah, I think there's a Fionn or a Fiacra and a Keelan.
Yes. And I love that. And as you say, then language is hugely important here too for Joan, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or her learning Irish is important to her.
To learn Irish. Yeah, I'm not sure entirely why. I think obviously it came into the story because I want to learn Irish. I think for Joan, it might be a connection. It could be a connection with childhood when I imagined her growing up in a rural area. As a child, she lives in the city now, but I think it might have been Irish, might have been more part for youth than it is in the city. And possibly, I think for Joan, because English language, conversing with people is so difficult, you know, perhaps there's this idea that if she finds another language, maybe it's something that might work better. I don't know. And that's only occurring to me now, really. But I'm always so interested to listen to writers who learn a new language and then go on to write in it, how they talk about having a different voice in the new language to what a different writing voice in their new language to what they has in their first language. So that's interesting me. So possibly Joan is searching for something in language that might help her. And if it's not in English, maybe it exists in some other language.
Yeah, another way to communicate with the world. And she is a bit of a mystery as well. I love that too. There's a lot of sort of unanswered questions about her mother and about her background, about her own childhood that's sort of hinted at, and there's allusions to it. And it gives, you know, and maybe she's not even willing to investigate that herself. But it's such a gorgeous book. And I mean, tender and beautiful. And obviously, knowing your work, it's exquisitely written. But lots of really funny moments too. And I loved that. Like, I did have a sort of a tear in my eye about Joan, but I also did laugh a lot through the book. It's just, it's such a vivid portrait of her, and I loved it. So you're going to read something for us from it now. Whereabouts are you going to read from?
So let me see. I think I'm going to read about the robot lawnmower. I think there's a robot.
Oh, yes.
So I'll just read a little snippet about the robot lawnmower. We were talking about those hens earlier, you know, and I'm not going to read a bit about the hens because I'd have to do voices, and I'm no good at doing voices.
Particularly, but yes.
Those pens came from the drawings of my visual artist friend, Siobhan Ray, who is also a teacher at the school where she teaches. They got hens. And rituals came out of a collaboration I did with Siobhan. She has a ritual called 8:30 ritual, where every morning since 1997 at 8:30, she does a drawing, 10 centimeter by 10 centimeter drawing at 8:30 with whatever materials she has to hand on, you know, at that time on that date. So she has decades worth of drawings at this stage. And she gave me a 3-month set of those drawings, and that was what I worked on.
Oh, let me see the cover, because I only have the proof here. Yeah, so I didn't see this cover. That's amazing.
Cover. So I responded to Siobhan's drawings, and then I gave her my first draft manuscript, and she responded to my draft manuscript. So on the back of the book, that that's a textile piece that with rabbits on it that Siobhan has made and painted and embroidered some of the words from the novel onto that textile piece. So Siobhan's school got hens, and the hens made it into the drawings, and that's how the hens made their way into rituals.
Made it into the book. I love this.
Yeah, that bit would require me doing too many voices, and I'm not good at doing voices when I'm reading. So I'm just going to read a little bit about the robot lawnmower.
Robot lawnmower.
So this is Joan at her bedroom window. From her bedroom window, she had a view over the hedge into next door's front garden. The view used to be more expansive, but recently the hedge, always neat on Joan's side, had become straggly and sprouting on her neighbour's. An unruly chin of a hedge that needed seeing to, the way that Joan needed to lie on her back at the salon once every second month while the therapist took the electrolysis machine to her face, zap, zap, zap. Joan still had a partial view, and now a movement along the front perimeter caught her attention. She squinted against the dusk. Yes, there it was again. Black and squat and beetle-like. The robot lawnmower. It had replaced next door's husband, who was gone some 4 months now, and who used to cut the grass religiously every Sunday. What was it doing out at this hour? Usually the lawnmower only came out of its kennel in the afternoons. Her neighbour insisted on referring to the kennel as a docking station, but docking stations were for moon landings, not small insectile things that crept around your grass on all fours. Why was it out there now, crawling about in the dark? One of the small children must have been playing with the controls again. The robot butted its head against the edge of a raised bed and, having registered resistance, drew back, butted again, a small bowl charging, this time connecting at a different angle. Then it conceded, gathered itself, and set off on a realigned course. Poor blind puppy, Joan thought. Day or night, it made no difference. The thing was left to feel its way about, bound by invisible strictures. It was the year of the robot lawnmower. She'd already spotted three others along the terrace, as if they were a notion that had taken hold, like au pairs. She pictured them all meeting in the overgrown lane behind the houses, discussing collective bargaining strategies, plotting sedition and revolt.
You've been listening to the wonderful Danielle McLaughlin, whose latest novel, Rituals, is out now with The Stinging Fly. See you all next time.